back to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik, and redicecreations.com is the website. This is our Thursday program, and we have invited back David Livingstone to join us. He, of course, is the author of The Dying God and Terrorism and the Illuminati. And last time we had David with us, we went over a lot of history, or rather the kind of occult version of history. We talked about civilizations, bloodlines, different groups of people, orders, and secret societies. And I thought that we could begin this program today here to move kind of onward or forward in time a little bit and talk about some of the other orders or secret societies and political groups that we didn't talk about last time. I'm thinking, for instance, of the Wahhabis, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Sabbatean Frankists, even the Knights of Malta, and then move up to the present day and talk about terrorism and groups like Al-Qaeda and the connection or involvement of some of the Western intelligence agencies. So I think this is going to be really interesting to hear more from David Livingstone and get some more of his from his perspective, so to speak. So with that, welcome back to the program, David. Nice to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me back.
So, you know, to begin on a somewhat lighter note, I guess, or I don't know, depressing note, maybe. Everything, how is everything over in the North American continent? I mean, the United States have a new president now that had been sworn in twice, I believe. What's your thoughts on Barack Hussein Obama, or does it even matter in the larger context of things that you're researching, David?
No, it doesn't at all. I think the same players, the same players still run the show. And if you look at the people who he's hired, you know, as his staff, then I think things are not looking good at all.
What about the, you know, there are speculation going around that he has a connection to the Muslim world, so to speak. What's your take on that?
Well, I think all you have to do is you look at for his video on, you can see his speech to AIPAC on YouTube. And if there's any doubts of his affiliations, that should be cleared up there. I don't know if you know what AIPAC is, but it's the leading pro-Israel lobby in the United States.
Indeed.
And he made his support of the Zionist cause very, very clear.
Yes, I don't think he's spoken out on the issue yet of what has happened recently in Palestine. And that's exactly, that shows a lot where he's standing, of course. So what do you think, all this other speculation around him, what his, you know, true political agenda is and so forth, is that just to confuse people further in the matter, or is it really something to it? What do you think?
I'm not sure. I'm not, you know, I wonder, I've done a little bit of research into his background to see what kind of a person he is, and I find it pretty mysterious. He went to an elite school in Hawaii. He spent some time. He did study at a Muslim school in Malaysia, but that doesn't mean anything, right? I mean, the Muslim world is full of imposters and phony organizations that act as fronts for all kinds of causes. So the fact that he went to a Muslim school doesn't mean that he was, it means that he was exposed to Islamic teachings, but what kind, you know, and for what purpose? I mean, you know, so much of the 20th century has been shaped by Islamic impostors. And really the greatest one is people often think that Aleister Crowley was pretty much the godfather of the 20th century through his influence of the occult underground. But really the true source, as I see it, would have been Jamal Afghani, who was this so-called Islamic reformer. And he was the one that was responsible for the diffusion of all these occult ideas to the West, and as well for the radicalization of a certain portion of the Islamic world. So, you know, which is basically, so he's the originator, the original source of the so-called clash of civilizations. So just to say that you know, a supposed Islamic background doesn't suggest, you know, any kind of separation from the occult agenda.
Right, absolutely. Well, I guess we can dive in right there and talk about then, I guess, the Muslim Brotherhood right away, because, you know, this is, from what I've heard, from what I've read and researched a little bit, set up by Hassan al-Banna, I think his name is. And
that's right.
Yeah, and I think that he, basically, it seems to be very much based on the Freemasonic structure in a little bit, like, in the same manner. And this is basically the group that the Islamic world has been given, much in the same way that the Western world has been given the Freemasonic branch of this. What do you think about that? Is that a correct statement, David, do you think?
Its origin, I'm not an expert on this. I've done as much research as I could, but there's a lot more certainly for me to discover, but it's rooted in a Masonic history. I don't think it really serves necessarily as a secret society, but I think it definitely serves as a tool of Western imperialism in the Middle East. And really, so we should go back to the history of all of this, because this is really what the whole, what it all impinges upon. And you have to understand that in Scottish Rite Freemasonry, the basis of it is this notion that when the Templars were in the Middle East, that they came into contact with a group called, that are referred to usually as Eastern mystics. And in Masonic literature, they're referred to as Johannite Christians, mm-hmm. because they adhere to St. John. This is clearly a reference to the Mandaeans, a Mandaean sect of Iraq. They've been actually in the news a little bit in the last couple of years because they've been threatened because of the Iraq war.
That's right.
So they still exist to this day.
They're a very small kind of Gnostic branch, isn't that right?
Gnostic branch, exactly. So they accept John the Baptist and reject Jesus. And so, yes, they are Gnostic branch. What's amazing is that if you look at the scholarship on Kabbalah, on the origins of Kabbalah, a lot of it focuses on the Mandaeans because the Kabbalah emerges very suddenly in the last half of the 12th century, between around 1130 and 1199.
Mm-hmm.
So it just bursts onto the scene. There's no account to where it could have been produced from. It represented ideas that had basically disappeared since the first centuries AD, and even represented ideas and leanings that a lot of mainstream Judaism had fought to suppress for many years. So how do you account for this sudden emergence of all these Gnostic doctrines? So if you look at scholars like Gershom Scholem, who is the most famous one, but probably the most in-depth studies, recent studies, were done by Nathaniel Deutsch. And again, he considers the similarities with Mandaean texts as a possible clue or link that would explain the continuity. So that would suggest, and even Scholem suggests this, that if these Kabbalistic ideas had survived anywhere, then it was potentially among the Mandaeans of Iraq. So then we come back to the Masonic legend that it was these Mandaeans who were responsible for having taught the Templars their Kabbalistic doctrines.
Well, I mean, the Mandaeans have been accused of everything from devil worship with their peacock symbol, basically, which goes back to an idea of that this is an image, I think, of Satan in the surrounding area. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the peacock connections, but it definitely leans in that direction. But what's more important is that the Mandaeans can pretty much be identified as essentially the same as the Sabians of Haran.
Okay.
And so there's some confusion as to the dual identity, but some scholars suggest that they're one and the same. So the Sabians of Haran are really the great source of occult doctrines to the Islamic world in the Middle Ages. This was Iran is a city in the southeastern portion of Turkey, and they're basically a community that had preserved the teachings of Neoplatonism and Hermeticism. And they used to worship Tammuz, and they again were accused of devil worship and human sacrifice and things like that, which is likely correct because of their adherence to this Kabbalistic tradition. And
what about the idea now that if we talk about the Mandaeans, then that they are being targeted and eradicated in that sense? Do you think that there's an interest from someone to preserve this people? I mean, when the U.S. goes into Iraq, I'm not sure in this point if they have been targeted by the U.S. or if it's the other way around. I have actually no information on that at all. But do you think that they are being, you know, exterminated, as it were, in some way or another? Or are they under the protection right now of the U.S.? Do you know?
I don't know. My suspicion is that they are so distant from the original tradition that they're no longer considered central to it, in a sense.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And I think they want to maybe marginalize them or you know, eliminate them as much as they can. But that's just my guess. I really don't have enough information on it.
Okay.
But the back to the Sabians, the important part is that the age of scholasticism in the European age of scholasticism, which was also took place around the same time that Kabbalah emerged in Europe.
Tell us a little bit more about that. The age of scholasticism? I don't know what that is.
Scholasticism. Mm-hmm. Well, Europe is considered to have gone two important renaissances. And the first one, so the second one was the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance. But the first one was what's called the age of scholasticism. And this emerged right around the time that the Kabbalah emerged, I guess, starting in the 12th century as well. Uh-huh. And so that's represented most primarily by Thomas Aquinas. And it's basically a rediscovery of Greek philosophy. And then the attempt to apply or use Greek philosophy in conjunction with Christian theology. And but what is usually not noted or made mainstream is the fact that that the age of scholasticism was influenced by the Muslim scholars, particularly Avicenna and Averroes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing is they were imitating the practice of these Islamic scholars in their application of Greek philosophy to Islam. And the group that was responsible for the dissemination of Greek philosophy to the Islamic world was the Sabians.
So do you think that they've been, how should we put it? They've been, the Islamic world has been reformed, and what we're seeing today isn't the true Islam or, you know?
Fortunately, it didn't infect Islam in that way. It didn't infect Islam in the formulation and development of the mainstream Sunni religion.
Mm-hmm.
So the process, the development of Islamic law, wasn't infected by Greek philosophy, but Greek philosophy infected Islamic culture for a period. But most of these scholars remained fairly marginal, and they weren't considered part of the mainstream community. And more importantly, the study of occult sciences led, particularly through Sabian influence, led to, first of all, the development of Sufism, which is considered the mystical approach to Islam.
Yeah.
But more importantly, the Ismailis. And the Ismailis are basically a Gnostic version of Islam. They're a sect, a very, very marginal sect, but they are very significant in occult history because out of the Ismailis came the Assassins. So it's supposedly from the Assassins, it's a historical fact that the Templars had contact with the Assassins.
Yes.
More speculative.
I don't know if you, if we talked about the assassins last time, but give us a little bit of background information, because that is a very fascinating group that has seems to have influenced a lot, both when it comes to the West and the East, actually.
Absolutely, because to jump ahead, I'll go back, but just to point to the relevance of this is that the modern day terrorists are understood esoterically as being the modern representatives of the assassins.
Mm-hmm.
So the assassins were an order that grew out of the Ismaili movement. They were headed by a character named Hassani Sabah. And they were basically the first terrorists. They're called assassins because they used hashish as a method of mind control. And so they were called hashishim, or referring to their use of hashish, or eaters of hashish. Yes. And that's the origin of our word assassin. According to Marco Polo, he described that that they would intoxicate these guys, and then they would create some kind of semblance of some ideal paradise. They would wake these guys up in their intoxicated state, and then they would be able to enjoy every pleasure, women and wine and whatever. And then they would, after they went back to sleep, they would be told that they had seen heaven, and that if they obeyed the leader, that they would go back, that he would show them how to re-enter heaven. And if he died for them, that he would re-enter heaven.
This is a very early form of mind control, I would say.
There's no doubt about it. You know, people wonder about the use of marijuana for mind control purposes. It seems to be the opposite, but that was definitely the first instance. And it's not an accident. And it's basically a large part of the reason for this affiliation with the legend of the assassins is for their early mind control techniques.
But weren't these guys also kind of like mercenaries? They could be by the right king in the region or leader that had the amount of money to pay the head guy of the assassins. They could basically rent these guys in order to pick out a guy from the other tribe or something like that. Isn't that right?
That's exactly it. So they were the first mind control assassins.
And
another very important point was the indoctrination process that the assassins went through. That you, when they were first, I guess usually they were probably Ismailis at the beginning, but when a recruit entered the lowest ranks, everything was still Islam. You know, everything was still the fundamental basics of Islam, but he thought he was entering some order, presumably to advance his knowledge in the religion and serve his religion and so on and so forth. But as they had several grades, and I can't remember if it was like 7 or 8 or 9. And as the recruit moved up the ranks, then he was required to change his understanding of Islam. So in the first rank, he would say maybe it would be that it's not Ismaili Islam that's right, it's some particular scholar that's right. And then he would move up to another stage, and then it would be certain other rules are for the low people, and this is the true way to practice Islam, and slowly move up to a point where he would actually eventually reject Islam entirely and accept, you know, this Gnostic occult doctrine as the true religion.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important, because this is the key, right? You're looking at a guy who basically starts out as a Muslim fanatic, who ends up behaving as a terrorist and posing as a Muslim, but really following some secret occult doctrine. And that very much explains what's happening in the 20th century.
That's interesting. I've heard also that, you know, the Knights Templar, for instance, were down in the region at that time, potentially learned this knowledge as well on how to use mind control, or even drugs in that sense, in order to get people under their spell, as it were. Do you think that's the case, that this was brought, the knowledge was brought into the West as well?
The knowledge was much more than that. The knowledge was Kabbalah. I believe what happened is the Templars discovered texts, because the Templars conducted they conducted excavations beneath the temple, and I believe that they discovered texts that had been buried there, and
what,
that's the
what
real
kind of
source.
Text? Do you know what kind of texts?
Just early Kabbalistic texts from that would have dated back from the first century AD, because even the Kabbalists at the time claimed that they had received the book. It's called the Sefer HaBahir, and that's the book that represents the emergence of the Kabbalah. And they, the Kabbalists of the time, claimed that it arrived to them from Palestine by way of Germany in bits, in fragments. Like basically tattered bits and fragments. Mm-hmm. So I believe that this is that they discovered books, and this explains why the doctrines basically had disappeared for 1,200 years practically before they reemerged by way of the Templars.
So
you're looking at a whole scheme of ideas that that emerged out of this, and it's out of that that the Zohar was compiled. And so I'm not sure of the role of mind control, but it's definitely the legend was definitely revived in modern times to, to support that idea. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure to what extent it actually served in that period, but also the use of intoxicants for occult purposes is at the core of this occult history, right? I mean, you go as far back as the dying god cult begins, and you will always find that it's always the same. It's usually, it involves music and intoxication and sex.
Well, there is an interesting idea about, if you go back even to Eleusis, for instance, their idea of the rye, or a form of wheat, I think it is, that has the, potentially had at the time the fungi ergot on it, which means that the mysteries of the whole spiel that they had there was in some way involved with the drugs. So it's very interesting if that is the background case of that,
sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Right.
Yeah. And that's the basis of it. And it's largely through this modern revival of this assassin legend that concept came about, and we can get back to that later. And it's through association with the Muslim Brotherhood.
But do you consider then that all this kind of mysticism going into other realms or something like this all is if we want to term it that, evil or bad, or do you think that something good can come out of it, of self-exploration or seeking what the human being is with the aid of natural means that exist on the planet?
I'm not sure, because I never experienced anything like that. I'm not sure what it is. Like, I don't know what astral projection is, things like that. So, I just think that truth is a lot simpler than that, and that it's not something that you achieve through rituals and drugs and that sort of thing.
All right. So this, what you're talking about here, mainly then, is a form of emergence of a monoculture that potentially was the agenda of the day at that time to both, I guess, then break down both the Islam or the Muslim world, but also I guess the Christian,
all religions.
All religions. Okay, so What's the plan here, do you think? Is this all about creating a new religion and a new age era? Is that the point here, or what do you see this is going?
Yes. It's about implementing the Kabbalah as the world religion.
Hmm. And you mentioned before the idea of, yep. Sorry to interrupt you, but you mentioned before the idea of, for instance, of the clash of civilizations, and you tie this back to Jamal Afghani, I think you mentioned.
That's right.
And so,
Go ahead.
Oh no, I just wanted to mention that. Do you think that this is the method that they've used in order to break down all what was previously, in order to, because there has been a clear dialectic here, so to speak, and many wars between Muslim and the Christian Western world. But the only necessary way for them in their own philosophy to merge these two is to come up with a synthesis of these two. And in this case, it's a form of Gnostic mysticism. Is that what you're saying?
I think that the Gnostic mysticism is a process to undermine it, to eventually replace it. Like, I don't think they're going to come out with a, you know, they want the world to accept Kabbalah basically unsullied, you know, I mean, for, it's not going to be accepting Sufism or Gnosticism or anything like that. It's not, but the Gnosticism is a process of indoctrination, just like the assassins, you know, it's like you move from stage to stage. And so the Gnostic Islam is a stage to get you to accept Gnosticism on its own or Kabbalah on its own.
Okay. And how do we tie in the Muslim Brotherhood in all this? They don't go back so far, I guess, and they're a fairly recent started group in that sense. Do you think that they've been used for this purpose then as well?
Yes, partly. So we should go back to the story of the Sabians.
Yes.
And because what happens is that there's this Johannite kind of legend basically takes over Freemasonry in the early 1800s. Sorry, not 1800s. And it basically becomes, it really takes over. It really becomes like this, the great mystery of Freemasonry at the time. This notion about the Templars getting their doctrines from these Eastern mystics, but we'll have to say Sabians. And so the order, of course, you know that the Illuminati was disbanded, but the order, according to Albert Pike, the order that takes over the leadership of the Illuminati at that point was the Asiatic Brethren.
Okay.
And the reason they're called Asiatic Brethren is because it's supposed to be referring to these Eastern mystics that the Templars had come into contact with. You follow me?
Yeah, with you.
So there's essentially supposed to be Sabian Mandaeans, you know, or something like that, except that they're existing in Europe in the early 1800s. But the Asiatic Brethren was created by Moses Dobruszka. And Moses Dobruszka was the nephew of Jacob Frank.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
Right. So if you read the books of Rabbi Antelman, who's a modern scholar, he was the one who, as far as I understand, who really pointed to this connection between Illuminati and the Shabbatean cult. And it really explains a lot.
Hmm.
Because Shabbatei Zevi, I think we talked about this last time, but when he declared himself a Messiah in 1666, and exactly, and this rocked the Jewish world at the time. Apparently, as much as half of the world's Jewish population accepted him as the Messiah. So you're talking about, you know, the Jews of North Africa, of the Middle East, of Europe, maybe as far as India and Afghanistan and places like that, had accepted this rumor of him being the Messiah, except that when he was invited to come before the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, the story goes that the Sultan gave an ultimatum that he either accepts Islam or death.
Yes.
And apparently he chose Islam, but he covertly converted to Islam. His followers did the same, but maintained their adherence to Shabbatei Zevi and the Kabbalistic doctrine in secret. And they survive to this day as a sect known as the Domine.
How do you spell that?
I can't remember the exact spelling. I always confuse it. It's D-O-E-H-M-E-A-M-E or D-O, something like that. D-O-E-M-E-H, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is a secret society or a sect?
They're secret Jews who basically pose as Muslims.
Okay.
I found a fascinating article recently on the internet about one member of the Domine community, because it's a real problem in Turkey, because they they are very powerful in the country, and they serve a lot of posts within the Turkish government. Because they have Muslim names and they pray in mosques and so on and so forth, but you know they also have other practices that they do on the Sabbath and so on and so forth. And so this one member of this community, he believes that it's time for them to come out and declare who they are and to stop living in secret. So he's receiving a lot of flack from the community for this, and who fear what exposure might mean to them. Mm. And the problem is that almost all of the members of the Young Turk movement who were involved in the overthrow of the Ottoman Empire were members of the Domne sect. And according to Gershom Scholem himself, he claims that Atatürk was a Domne as well.
Hmm.
And now, so the branch of the Domne in Europe were centered in Poland, and their leader was Jacob Frank, who did very much this, except he didn't convert to Islam. His belief was that it was necessary for his people to convert to Christianity, and they did. And they assumed Christian names, and a lot of them intermarried into Austrian aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is they were linked to Maria Theresa and sort of merged with her family.
Okay.
And so Rabbi Antelman claims that Rothschilds were Shabbateans.
Right, right.
And which explains a lot. It explains because the development of Kabbalah, even according to Gershom Scholem, hits its high point essentially. Like the trajectory that he traces for Kabbalah is, you know, 12th century emergence that I talked about. Then most importantly, Isaac Luria, who's the great modern reformer of Kabbalah. Okay. And then it is Shabbatai Zevi, who is sort of the great formulator of Lurianic Kabbalah. And then Zevi succeeded by Frank.
And I think that Jacob Frank, or Jakob Frank, he was, wasn't he believed that he was like the reincarnation of Sabbatai Zevi or something like that?
Exactly. He did.
Mm.
And now his nephew creates the Asiatic Brethren, who basically are naming themselves after the Sabians of Haran, essentially, or the Mandaeans, whatever. But the idea is the same Johannite sect that the Templars had been in contact with. And there's also the concept in Scottish Rite Freemasonry is that the Templars actually rescued a number of these Eastern mystics and brought them to Scotland. And that this is supposedly then the origin of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Presumably, then that's how they enter the bloodline as well.
So, do you think? To cut you off there, but do you think that this also then potentially might explain the idea of if we talk about Freemasonry, for instance, they allegedly don't care, so to speak, if you have a belief in Allah or in God or Yahweh or who, you know, whatever God you can pick and choose, basically, as long as you believe in a deity that is above yourself,
Lucifer.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
I think that's very much the key. You know, the concept is, you know, people wonder what roles the Illuminati prefer to play, and the usual assumption would be politicians, but the truth is usually as religious leaders. And because if I found any belief that they hold in common, the belief that I found is the notion that if you look at Leo Strauss, Plato, Jamal Afghani, they all held to this belief that people are weak, that they are unable to accept the truth, which is that there is no truth. So they need myths to be led. And so they believe that people need religion, that they need some, according to them, phantom. They need to believe in some phantom in the sky and an afterlife and things like that,
right.
To comfort them from, you know, the dark reality in their minds. So they believe that you can't just come forward and tell people how it is, that you have to use religion to manipulate them. And this is what they all believe. So whether it's Buddhism or Islam or Christianity or Judaism, they will usually tend to use these religion, or it's communism or democracy. There's many other cults that they manipulate, right?
Sure.
That they use to manipulate people. So yes, you'll find them posing as various types of religious reformers, but really they're all part of the same agenda.
Well, it doesn't matter in that sense, as you say, because it's all about disempowering the human beings on this planet that's the main agenda as I see it, and it doesn't matter in what form you encapsulate that or whatever. And also, I think that this, what you mentioned about that they've been, that they believe that people are not prone to take care of themselves, they need leaders, they need some kind of religious guidance or what have you. To this day, this probably, unfortunately, is kind of true, because they have worked. What I was getting at is basically that what their idea or their philosophy then is that people need to be led, either by a leader or a belief in God or whatever. And I think that to this day, that's probably actually true, because they themselves, many of these groups and religious orders from the get-go, has been very instrumental in breaking down the human being, meaning that they haven't given the space that to discover themselves. They haven't been given the space in order to understand themselves and to develop on their own. They have been very much the power have been taken away from them, which means that they become very susceptible to a leader or a power elite or an idea of a god, right? So I mean, it's a relationship there that the leaders, at least today and previously in history, of course, as well, they want to take the power away from us in order to put themselves in a position where they can guide civilization, where they can rule over people and decide, what is right and what is wrong, basically.
I think the root part of the problem is people are not enough aware of the threat of hypocrites. To use a simple word, but I'm using the word, what I mean is imposters, really. Because even if you look at the New Testament, and Jesus warned against hypocrites as well. And it's very much a concern in the Quran. I mean, it's repeated over and over and over. And I think the people just don't, Christians, Muslims, whoever, they just don't realize the role that imposters play. Because, it's not to say that there is no God, or that the basis of these religions is not true or accurate. I believe that it is. It's just that it's manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just like a guy like George Bush. All he has to do is say he's Christian, and then people will accept anything. And the Christians will accept anything that he says.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way that that these Muslim reformers, they'll use all the right language, they'll refer to this scholar and that scholar and this tradition and have all kinds of proof, supposed proof for the things that they're claiming. But Muslims are just not wary enough of the fact that people will try to mislead them, and they will try to mislead them through the religion.
Mm.
I find this is one of the big lessons, and this is exactly how guys like Jamal Afghani and Bin Laden and the Ayatollah and all these imposters have basically used the trust, the naive trust of Muslims and other imposters of any other religion and this is exactly what the neoconservatives believed in as well too. They recognized that to achieve their objectives, that they were going to have to gain the support of the Christian community. And, most of these guys have Zionist leanings, but they recognize that they had to shroud their doctrines
in
Christian language,
yes,
so that they could basically derive the support of the Christian community. And they have.
Yeah.
Just by appending Christian, terminology or whatever it took to do it, but it works.
Do you also think that, because let's say to the rest of the world that's outside the US, many people in Europe or what have you are looking at these leaders and say, oh my God, they are Christian, they are the most evil people there is, so let's not go there in our ideology in that sense. Do you think that religion in that sense has played out its role? It's definitely very much influential still, obviously. I mean, there are millions, you know, dedicated to the Roman Catholic Church, for instance. There are a lot of, you know, Muslims, obviously. But do you think that they're slowly trying to phase out religion as the source that people should turn to, so to speak, for guidance?
Absolutely, because, you know, we call it religion, but all it means is it's self-knowledge, and you know, and I mean self-centeredness in a good sense, like self. I mean self. I can't think of another word for it.
But I think I know what you mean. You're not talking about egoism here, but you're talking about self-discovery and responsibility and living your own life and not someone else's, right?
Exactly, and so it's just, you know, recognizing God is just recognizing an ultimate reality and an order and a good and a purpose. And this is the very basis that people are longing for to understand. And then is to understand, how do you serve that? And it's very simple. You just serve that by seeking justice, by believing that things should be just, that there's a moral order that should be followed. Not the opposite, which is what the Illuminati was teaching, is that there is no moral order, and that it's a struggle for the fittest, that there's some who are superior and the rest who are a bunch of losers. And so the superior ones have the right to rule over and deceive, if necessary, the rest. That's the opposite.
Right. And the thing is that, you know, that I want to put in there is that they don't ask anyone for permission, so to speak. They just act, they just do what they want to do. And either people are foolish enough to go along with it, if you will, or, you know, they stand up against it. Many people who have of course been picked off the main stage, so to speak, and are not around anymore. But ultimately I see that this is a very much an individual battle, meaning that if you're smart enough or clever enough, you can just phase out of all these other ideologies, all these other political schemes, whatever it is, basically, that is trying to get into your head and rule you and make you think in their terms, so to speak.
I agree totally. And that's the thing, is that, you know, really religion is supposed to be very much an individual relationship. It's you're accountable for yourself. So you can't rely on these teachers all over the place to tell you what you're supposed to believe. You have to assess, it on your own terms. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's a huge step. So it's very easy for people to say they're Christian or they're Muslim, but it's a whole other step for them to say that I fear God alone. You know, I leave the final judgment for what I believe is true between myself and God. And because that's how people get misled. And this is the same problem that goes back, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 years. You look back, you know, this is exactly what happened to Judaism. This is how it got corrupted, is that people lost the basic simplicity of what it meant as far as their personal transformation, and they turned it into a cult.
Right. I mean, the priesthoods are taking over the power, and that's the main, you know, that's the wrong step that the people do, that they align themselves to human beings and their ideologies instead of their own, you know, as you say, either if one has a belief in a higher source or a God or whatever, I mean, that's fine. That doesn't bother me, or shouldn't bother anyone else as well. But they're very smart and clever, because they know how to sidestep that, I think, initial and very, very, you know, honest approach to a spiritual life, if you will, on this planet. That, okay, something is probably up there, you know, bigger than me, or out there, or, you know, nature, the universe, or God, whatever it might be. But this is being sidetracked all the time and hijacked, if you will.
Right. Because, I mean, I believe you can have just leaders, but you have to assess them on their degree of their alignment with truth, as opposed to just their saying so.
Yeah.
And this is what's happened, right? This, you know, if you look at early Jewish history, you know, there was righteous leaders, but it's, you know, it's not that all priests are manipulators. It's that some of them are posing, are imposters.
Sure.
You know, there to lure you away, and so they will basically mar the religion, bastardize it, to lure you away, and to basically then really the religion becomes a disguise for evil. It becomes an excuse for evil. I mean, religion, this is people's complaint, is that religion is the cause of most of the evils, you know, most of the wars in the world. It's a ridiculous thought, but it really,
well, it's true.
What, Well, it's not. I mean, most people have died, you know, okay. in the cause of democracy than religion.
Well, I think that's actually a religion in itself, but that's another discussion.
Exactly. But that wasn't religion. That was nationalism disguised as religion, and that's a very different thing.
Yeah, it is.
Or whatever other, or whether it's greed disguised as religion, or whatever it is. But it's not religion.
Okay, let's see here, David, if we can maybe begin to round things up here for the first segment. It's been very interesting hearing more from you. We have a lot more to talk about here in the second segment, if you're up for that. I mean, I'd love to talk more about the Wahhabis, maybe get into a little bit more about the Rosicrucians, Freemasonry, but mainly go up to, again, as we try to do here, go up to the modern day a little bit and talk about terrorism, 9/11 and so forth. But tell people your website, the book titles that you have out there, and how people can go about getting copies of those, David.
Right, I have two books. The first, they essentially complement each other. The first one is called The Dying God: Hidden History of Western Civilization, and this is really the thorough background research into the history of what I refer to as Dying God worship, which is really the cult belief system. But I stop at the French Revolution, and I stopped there because it would have been too large a book to continue on from that. But it also finishes the story. So the website for that one is thedyinggod.com. You can purchase my book at Amazon, or you can special order it at a bookstore. And the second book is called Terrorism and Illuminati, and that discusses a lot of what we've been talking about this morning. But it's called a 3,000-year history because it also goes back. I discovered a lot of things that I didn't realize. My first book helped very much to give a foundation to my second book, but there's a lot of things that I discovered about ancient history that served to this, explaining the role and function of terrorism in our time. So that's why it traces so much of a background. And that book you can find, or the website for that book is terrorism-illuminati.com. And again, actually, my entire book for that one can be read online. I've also got a free PDF available that can be downloaded from the site. And otherwise, it can be bought at Amazon again, or any local bookstore should be able to order it.
Okay, very good. We'll have the website up on redicecreations.com as well, and links to the books in case you want to get yourself a copy. Thank you very much, David, for this first segment. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
More of David Livingstone in the Red Ice members area. We'll talk about Al-Qaeda, the jihad ideology, the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, more on the Asiatic Brethren, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Egyptian Freemasonry. And we'll discuss terrorism, the drug wars, corruption, and propaganda in high places. So more material from David's research coming up. RedIceCreations.com is the website. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk more after this break. Madam Insane.